We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with the author of the book I Shall Not Hate, A Gaza Doctor's Journey on the Road to Peace and Human Dignity. Our guest is the physician, Izzeldin Abuleish. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Dr. Abuleish was interviewed on last Wednesday by David Inge on Focus on this station, and it was a wonderful interview. I got to hear most of it, and I was traveling at the time. Today we're going to be talking about some of the other issues that I think are so important in his history and his story. He is a Muslim, and we're going to be talking about the place that his faith had in his decisions after his three daughters were so tragically killed in the Gaza war. Dr. Abuleish, as you were growing up in your book, this wonderful memoir of your life growing up in Gaza, you were born in one of the refugee camps there. You talk about when you were 11 years old, you won a prize for memorizing parts of the Quran. And that money was very important to your family at that time. Would you tell us a little bit about what it was like to memorize the parts of the Quran when you were 11?
It was a time in my life when I went to the school to read Quran after in the afternoon, after finishing the ordinary school.
After class.
After class, and to go there because you are fighting to live. And you want to learn and to earn some money to help your family. So I went to the Quran school in the afternoon to learn by heart and to compete how much did I keep by heart. And I learned and to run for the competition. And I remember that time I succeeded at the age of 11 to be one of those who got that award. It was 2.5 pounds, 3 pounds, Egyptian pounds at that time.
That was when Egypt was in control of Gaza.
Administrating yes. Gaza Strip. And to receive that award from the governor of the Gaza Strip and to go with that money to give my mother. Till now, how can we challenge and to succeed? And that's the right way. Don't give up.
Now you grew up speaking Arabic, and of course the Quran is written in Arabic. But who taught you, who helped you learn it?
I learned it from the school, and the reading it after the school, it helped me. When I am listening to Quran or someone to speak in Arabic, immediately I can feel the mistakes in the grammar and the language, because it's a beautiful language, and you know it is not harmonized. It's not going with each other. And when someone recites Quran, immediately I feel I am following up with him, and I can recite with. And it strengthened my faith, my belief with Quran, with the religion, to know about other religions.
Now, you were born in 1955 in this refugee camp in Gaza, in the Palestinian territories. You're 56 years old now. I think I figured that out right.
Yes.
And do you still remember any of what you memorized?
I remember everything in the Jabali refugee camp.
Could you recite a little bit from the Quran? Do you remember anything from the Quran?
Of course, you know. Do you want me to recite?
Yes, I'd love that in Arabic.
عسى أن تكرهوا شيئا وهو خير لكم وعسى أن تحبوا شيئا وهو شر لكم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والضحى والليل إذا سجى ما ودعك ربك وما قلى وللآخرة خير لك من الأولى، ولسوف يعطيك ربك فترضى. ألم يجدك يتيما فآوى، ووجدك ضالا فهدى، ووجدك عائلا فأغنى. فأما اليتيم فلا تقهر، وأما السائل فلا تنهر، وأما بنعمة ربك فحدث. صدق الله العظيم.
When your daughters were so tragically killed in the home where you were living in Gaza during the war, when the Israelis were attacking Gaza, and there were tanks in the street and one parked right across from your home, your first words, which people have heard all around the world because they were captured from your phone to an Israeli journalist who was on live television in Channel 10 in Israel at the time, your cries from your heart were words that included Allah, Allah, God,
yes.
God. Were you praying?
I appeal to God.
Uh-huh.
To talk to God. And as you said, I remember it now. I said it, Ya Allah, what did we do for them to kill my daughters? What have they done? They did nothing. Because at times of need and even in welfare, we must direct our face to God. God is the largest. And if we need to appeal, to ask God and to direct our face to God, who is the helper and can help us.
In your very good book, I Shall Not Hate, you talk about how anger is legitimate. You feel it's appropriate to be angry when there's injustice, when there's inhumanity, when there's the lack of respect for the dignity of others. And you yourself have received not only violence from Israelis, but you yourself have received kindness. And I was started, to, as I read through your book, I was taking notes on the various Jewish Israeli folks who reached out to you with love and who also did not hate. The family that you stayed with when you were 14 and 15 that one summer, and where you earned enough money to come back and again give to your family to help them buy a new house. Your summer wages,
yes,
was, as a 15-year-old, was enough to buy a very small, modest home for your family after the home that they had been in had been bulldozed when Ariel Sharon felt that the tanks needed wider streets. But that family reached out to you, and you were able to see them again, you report, when after you were a doctor and you were actually practicing in Israel, delivering not only Arab Muslim babies, but Jewish Israeli babies as an obstetrician. How did it feel to go back and talk to that Jewish family after you were a successful doctor, in spite of all odds?
It was in 1970. And after that, in 1994, I was in Jerusalem participating in a conference. And during this period, 24 years, I was thinking of them. I wanted to go there. And in my way back from Jerusalem to Gaza, I said, it's time. I was thinking of them as my family, and I wanted to go there to see the parents alive and to hug them and to show them that there is hope and that the relationship is not the transient. I am thinking of them, and we can continue. I went at that moment and that day to meet, and I saw them, even the son. When I knocked the door, his daughter, in 1970, she was newly born. And she said to me, what do you want? Now she's 24. Said, I want to meet your dad. She introduced me, and he thought that I am a businessman, Palestinian, because there is Palestinians and Israelis who are dealing together. And when he came, I said to him, I am Izzeldin. This child, the boy who worked here, we hugged each other. As two beloved ones, two members of family that we have been far away. And the first question I asked, how is your mother? How is your father? And his mother said, I remembered you now. That boy, when he entered the chicken cube, what is he doing? It's not his place. This child will succeed. And I succeeded.
You were there cleaning out chicken poop.
Chicken coop. And to work for them. And this is the bride.
Yes.
It's not shame to work.
Yes.
The shame is too big and to ask others.
Uh-huh.
You need to show that you can survive and you can succeed and to challenge all of that.
But Dr. Abelaish, you had many advantages, even though you were born in a refugee camp in Gaza. You were intelligent. You were physically healthy. There were others, I'm sure, who weren't, who didn't have your gifts of mind or a healthy body. I mean, yes, you were able to work, but so many can't, I think.
I don't think that I'm exceptional.
Really?
I don't think. We have the same situation. We have the same strength and determination. And to move forward, to challenge all of those challenges that we think, the barriers, it's artificial in our mind. Don't think that you are poor or you are weak. You are strong with your goodwill. And don't give up. Be focused. Be determined. It may take time. But at the end, you will reach there.
I would say some may reach there.
Okay, it's good. Those some who reaches there, who can reach there, it's a moral responsibility and obligation to help those who are behind.
I like that.
We need that. Uh-huh. It's not, I am reaching there and I am far. I must reach there, putting in my mind. And I am focused. And remember, some people are behind and waiting for me to save them, to bring them and to follow me. That's what have we missed and lost in life as a human being. We need to understand and to work for it.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with the medical doctor, Izzeldin Abelaish, who's the author of I Shall Not Hate, A Gaza Doctor's Journey on the Road to Peace and Human Dignity. Let me give the phone numbers so the listeners may join this conversation. If you're listening and it's a long-distance call, even if you're listening on the Internet into the far reaches of the U.S., I don't know about Canada. I know you live in Toronto now with your five remaining children. I don't know about Canada. These international calls, you'll have to find out. But in the U.S., continental U.S., you may call 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station. If it's a local call, 217-333-9455. Dr. Abelaish, I was mentioning your Muslim faith and its relationship to the decisions you've made to not dwell in the past with the horrible events of your life and the death of your three daughters violently before your eyes, but you've chosen to look forward, to move forward. You've started a foundation, daughtersforlife.com. People can go online and learn about daughtersforlife.com. You've started this foundation wanting to look forward. Does your faith, does the Quran, does the Muslim religious tradition give you reason to hope, to look to the future for a better time?
All of them together. My profession as a human being, the religion, the faith, and even the wisdom, we must adopt that way. And the history, what happened? The history can't be undone. But we can learn from it. As a medical doctor, we look to history. For what we take the history? To build the present and the future. To learn from it, not to repeat what happened in the history, especially of the mistakes. The mistakes are there to learn from them, not to repeat them. So my faith helped me that always to be an eye on the present and the future.
You talk about being a medical doctor in your book, I Shall Not Hate. Let me read just a short little passage here from one place in your book that I thought was so moving, where you talk about how you really just love your work. And you say, I love my work because a hospital is a place where humanity can be discovered, where people are treated without racism, where people are treated as equals. In the brotherhood and sisterhood of medicine, we take an oath to care for the sick when we graduate, whether it's the Hippocratic Oath or the Prayer of Maimonides or the Declaration of Geneva. No matter where in the world we graduate or what language we speak, we leave our differences outside the walls, and we're dedicated in the hospital to saving lives. You say, certainly I cannot speak for everyone, but in your experience, you say, the Israelis that you worked with see the patient, not the nationality or the ethnicity. And your one daughter who was so severely wounded in the attacks in Gaza, you took to a hospital in Israel where she was helped and was able to save her eyesight?
Yes, and that's medicine and health, which is highly valued by everyone, not only Palestinians and Israelis. And medicine, it has one face. It has a human face. Whether Palestinians, Israelis, Canadian, American, anyone, when we treat patients, we don't ask. Or to tailor the treatment according to the name, religion, background, or ethnicity, we have one goal: to save and to cure the patient. And that's what do I urge leaders to learn from doctors who are messengers of humanity, to save lives. Can they practice this outside the borders of the hospitals, to learn from what is practiced within, to give others equality, justice, respect, and to value human life? The happiest moment for us when we save a patient. You will see that we speak proudly about it, and we feel satisfied. That's the success and that's the happiness that we all missed and trying to find.
You talk about choosing light. And interestingly, in the Christian scriptures that were read this morning, this Sunday morning, in churches all over the world, including Christians on the West Bank and Christians in Gaza, who follow the lectionary. The passage was from the Hebrew Bible, from the book of Deuteronomy, from the Torah, the Jewish Torah, where God said through Moses, one of the prophets that Muslims recognize as well, I set before you life and death. Choose life. That was the passage that was read in Christian churches all around the world today. And in your book, you mentioned that you choose life, you choose light. You say that, and I quote, hatred leads to many chronic diseases. You say, I choose to be healthy and not to be a revenger. Vengeance and an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth has been a byword so long in so many nations and in so many faiths, including Christianity, of course, which has a very violent history. But you're choosing at this point as a 21st century Muslim from Gaza not to try to avenge the death of your daughters, but to work for light and for life. How can you do that?
Because we have a choice. We have a choice as a life. As you said, you see the light and you see the darkness. And we are blessed to have our minds to think of and to use the right way. As you said, soul to soul, eye to eye, teeth to tooth with teeth. But at the end, the completion of the phrase, it says, if you endure patiently and forgive, God will reward you. What do we need more than the reward from God? And do you think those holy and noble souls, girls, what do they want from me to bring them the justice that they sacrifice their blood? And do you think hate, revenge, anger will help me and help them? It will destroy me and destroy others. It is not the right. You can't deal negative with negative, positive with positive. You need negative with positive. Darkness needs the light. Hate needs the love. Ignorance needs the knowledge and the wisdom. That's what do we need. We must choose. It may be painful. The pain, I admit, the pain is there. The wound is deep. But it energizes me not to lose control and the compass and direction.
You mentioned in your book that forgiveness is, of course, very important, and it's an important concept in the Quran. And I want to read a few sentences from the Quran about forgiveness. But you also say in your book that it can come too soon. Forgiveness can come too soon. You say, in my opinion, coexistence and cooperation, partnership and sharing at the grassroots level is the only way forward for Palestinians and Israelis. Rather than talking about peace or forgiveness, first let's talk about trust, dignity, our shared humanity, and the 100,000 other steps it takes finally to achieve peace and forgiveness. I thought that was very insightful.
And that's what I think. Some people, they think peace. What is peace? Is it the political peace that we are fighting for, that we need leaders to decide? Even any peace treaty is the first step in the long journey to human peace. Peace, in my understanding, how you feel safe, secure, happy and healthy and a human, being a human, and to behave as a human. So it is not to impose a political peace here or there. And then many times, peace treaties, they failed. It's not the absence of war or conflict. It's the absence of oppression or occupation. Peace is the freedom of ignorance, of arrogance, of unemployment, of sickness. That's peace that we all lost.
And when I was talking to an Israeli journalist on this program a few years ago, he was here as a visiting scholar at the university, he said, and I think you probably would agree with him, that from the Israeli perspective, peace is an ultimate goal, but they must first feel secure from the nations that are so powerful all around them, for them to feel they can trust and can respect the dignity of people who some of them want to drive them into the sea.
I can say to you, the fear, they must ask themselves, why are they afraid? Fear.
They're very small, very few Israelis.
Why?
Compared to the Arabs all around.
Why are they afraid from the Arabs?
Well, they've been attacked.
Why? continue. That's what do we want. There is an end. When we ask a patient, this is a symptom. Fear is a symptom. It's not a disease. Okay. Behind this symptom, there is a disease. Yes. There is a Palestinian nation which is occupied, oppressed, and they are asking for their freedom. And they, if, to get rid of this fear, to help the Palestinians, even to say to them, we are afraid of you. Mm-hmm. What can be done to be freed from our fear and to help you to get your freedom? Uh-huh. To be honest with each other, not to hide behind this fear of denying the others. And what did you say about always this myth, Palestinians, we want to throw the Israelis in the sea?
Well, Hamas has said that.
No, it is not nothing. It's this myth, it's not new. It was after 1948, it has been used and misused. And there was a good saying after 1948 to ask David Ben-Gurion, what are you going to do with Palestinians? He said, don't worry. The old will die and the young will forget. After six decades, neither the old Palestinian died nor the young forget, and Israel is still there. So both are reality living. Can we change and get rid of those myths and to deal what is going on with fact that there is a Palestinian nation and an Israeli nation, and to give both of them the rights and the freedom they lost and they are fighting for? The Israelis to get rid of their fear and to realize one thing, their safety, security is linked to the safety and security of the Palestinians, not dependent upon the safety and security of the Palestinians. The Israeli future is related to the Palestinian future. There will never be peace that is just and good for one. That's what I said. It must be good for both, and by choice, not by force. That's what do we need and want to look for, the long-term sustainable future for both nations.
Let me read what it says in the Quran in Surah 42 about forgiveness. Those who avoid the greater crimes and shameful deeds, and when they are angry, even then forgive. And later, the recompense for an injury is an injury equal thereto in degree. But if a person forgives and makes reconciliation, his reward is due from Allah, for Allah does not love those who do wrong.
And that's what I said.
A strong
and that's what I said. Emphasis. Some people misunderstand Islam. They think Islam recommends revenge, soul to soul, teeth to teeth, eye to eye. But I said it before, if you endure patiently, patience is the key to success. If you endure patiently and forgive, God will reward you. What do we need? What do we want more than the reward of God?
Another example from the Quran a little bit farther on in Surah 42 says exactly that. But indeed, if any show patience and forgive, that would truly be an exercise of courageous will and resolution in the conduct of affairs.
And as you said, forgiveness also, it has requirements. This is concerning the victim, but we need to encourage the perpetrator also, because forgiveness is mutual. Right. Between two parties, the perpetrator must take responsibility and to take his part of this forgiveness, to ask for forgiveness, to take responsibility if we want order in this world.
I thought your balance was admirable in your book when you talk in I Shall Not Hate about acknowledging that the years of rockets being fired from Gaza into Israel did make the Israeli, of course, afraid, and they saw people who were injured as well. In the next paragraph, or maybe it was the previous paragraph, you talked about the Palestinians and how much they'd suffered from the deprivation, from the borders, from all of the horrible experience trying to travel anywhere, and the fact there's no jobs and no food, and all of the all of the blockades of goods, necessary goods going into Gaza. But I thought you showed an admirable balance, being able to talk about faults on both sides, violence on both sides.
We must be honest and to see by our two eyes. As I used to say, the coin has two sides, not to see one side. There is violence, and to show that violence is useless, is futile, we have to admit that and to admit the rights of all with rockets, with military, brutal engines. It will never help us. There is suffering in both sides, but the suffering is not equal. But there is suffering, and how can this suffering help us to learn from it, to avoid it, even to find a way of not adding more suffering to put an end to this suffering?
Your book describes very well the sufferings of the Gazans. We have a caller waiting on line number one. Let's let someone else join the conversation, and let me give those numbers again for others. 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listening area. If it's long distance, perhaps you're listening online, and that's 1-800-222-9455. And because this station does need to lower its power right at sundown, that'll come before this program ends. So some who are listening on their AM station may want to go to their computer to hear the rest of this live, or you can go to the FM HD3 perhaps and get a better signal. FM HD3 if you do have an HD radio. And of course, if you miss part of this program and would like to hear it at your convenience, you may do that at will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. Just leave the G off after in the word keeping, keeping the faith, and you'll find a whole list of all of our past programs. This will be put on the air in just a couple days on the so you can hear it on your computer. But line number one, you're speaking with our guest today, Izzeldin Abulaish, who's the author of I Shall Not Hate. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Abulaish, it's an honor to talk to you, and I have great respect for your conversion of this terrible, horrible experience of you and your family to something extremely positive. I just wanted to note, as an American, that something that I find very sad is that we often don't realize, partially because of a variety of political and media sort of misinformation in some cases, just lack of knowledge in others, we don't realize the level of suffering of Palestinians and, of course, of many Jewish people in Israel as well. And something I just want to note is that it's in terms of numbers, something you would never hear in the American media, generally speaking, but if you look at UN numbers, in the 2009 Gaza war, the official numbers are that there were roughly 1,500 Palestinians killed, roughly 700 of which were women and children, about 400 children, from what I understand. There were 13 Israelis killed, 13 versus 1,500. And of those 13, most were of the Israeli military. Three civilians were killed. So people have to realize the level of difference. The level of difference in terms of, you know, this when it does come down to a conflict, that these so-called missiles are very small rockets, and that it is very, very sad and horrific what people are trying to do in sending those missiles. On the other hand, the crushing of the Palestinian people has to be recognized. I wanted to also take note of the fact that there's a very interesting article by Bernard Avishai in the New York Times today on a possible peace plan, and I really hope that, you know, someone would come forward, such as Obama, with some real, courage to make a peace plan work, which would not be easy, obviously. But it's so essential to stop the devastation, especially of the Palestinians.
Caller, would you mind, before ringing off, repeating information of where that peace plan could be found?
Oh, it's on the New York Times Magazine, the cover of it.
The magazine, okay, fine.
Article today.
Sure, today's. Okay, great.
And one thing I wanted to note is something that disturbs me as an American is someone I know quite well was at an evangelical church in the last couple of years, and they noted that the minister publicly, in front of the entire congregation, called for the deaths of all Muslims. And this kind of thing, I think, is very, very sad that Americans have resorted to this kind of hatred, and I do hope that it's not common, but I fear that many evangelicals in particular, but others as well, have really misunderstood Islam, misunderstood, of course, the fact that there are many Palestinian Christians as well, but Islam more generally. I think it's really essential that people learn more about Islam, about Islam's history, and about the varied societies in which Islam exists. So many different societies, from Indonesia to Malaysia to, of course, the areas around the Arabian Peninsula and Turkey and so forth. Anyway, thank you very much, and thank you very much for your great work.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate very much the call. Let me give the numbers again, 333-9455, Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455. We are about halfway through our program today on Keeping the Faith with our guest, medical doctor Izzeldin Ebulaish. Let me spell the last name, A-B-U-E-L-A-I-S-H. His book is I Shall Not Hate. It came out just last year in 2010, about a year and a half after the tragic deaths of his three daughters and one of his nieces in their home in Gaza from a tank shell, two tank shells that went into their bedroom. Your house was very well known, Dr.
But I would
Appleby.
Like really
yes.
to the listener to respond.
Yeah. Oh, yes, would you
yes,
like
I think, you know, I agree with him, the ignorance of the people and the reality and the truth, they can search for it and to find it, to learn and to know.
People around the world can
around
learn.
The world, they can learn and to take responsibility about that learning and to search for the truth, not to be biased here or there. And as he mentioned, the human being are human being, they are equal. Killing one, you kill the world. To save one, you save the world. All religions. 1,500 Palestinians...
And that's a quote from the Quran.
Yes, yes. 1,500 Palestinians were killed and they became numbers. Without names, without faces, and when you speak about someone else, one to be killed, you will start to speak about a person, about a human being, and they can start to make stories about him, books. And what did you say about the peace plan? The peace plan is there. The roadmap is there. The international resolutions, the agreements are there, but it needs a courage to implement
political will
to implement those plans. We don't want to invent the wheel. It's there and it's ready, but you need the courage and the political will from the current leaders to take it and translate it into action.
We have another caller waiting. I'm going to ask that caller to exercise the same patience that a little bit of the patience that our guest today has shown. Because I do need to remind people that you're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, I'll be talking with University of Illinois Professor Brant Houston from the Department of Media about some studies he's done on poverty in Champaign County. On February 27th, Elizabeth Buckley will be our guest. She's a very noted soloist who had her debut in Carnegie Hall. She'll be talking a little bit about that and use of music as a way of advocacy and outreach. On March 6th, our guest will be Clayton Doffenbaugh talking about ecology. And on March 13, we're very fortunate to have two of the major translators of the Common English Bible that's coming out just this year, Joel Green from Fuller Theological Seminary in California and Lib Caldwell from a seminary in Chicago. We'll be talking with them about their work on the Common English Bible. Those are some of the programs coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. Support for this program has been provided for a number of years from the University of Illinois YMCA. The University Y was started back in 1873 and was the first religious organization for students on this campus. Some of its current programs are open to the public. On the 18th of February, Kathy Kelly, who's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We'll be speaking about prophetic voice, public witness, searching for a nonviolent approach. That's at the noon Friday forum, the 18th of February, this coming Friday at noon. It's a free lecture. If you'd like to order lunch, call the Y at 333. Now I've blanked on the number I've known by heart for all these years. At any rate, call University Y. 1500-333-337-1500 is the number if you'd like to reserve a lunch. But, of course, you can take your own or simply listen to the lecture. Coming up later at the Y at their Spring Tuesday lecture series, the first one starts on the 22nd. That's Tuesday, February 22nd. A professor from the theater department, Lisa Gay Dixon, will be talking about a Midsummer Night's Dream. It's a bacchanal. That'll be on the 22nd, again at noontime at the University Y, the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street. There'll be 23 portraits by Jason Patterson of influential African-American women with roots in Champaign-Urbana and the University of Illinois at the Y. Starting February 24th, there'll be an opening of that exhibition at 7 o'clock that Thursday night. The artist will talk about 8 o'clock. That exhibition will be at the University Y until April 1st. So 23 portraits of important African-American women. Well, our guest on the show today has been patient, and so has our caller on line number one from Urbana. You are finally on the air. Go right ahead.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you, Dr. Abelish, for your work. In reading the book, I was impressed by many things, and one of the things that grabbed my attention was the difficulty that Palestinian people, especially in Gaza, have in traveling, and the frustrations that you experienced as you crossed from one country to the next and so forth. Could you describe a little bit what that's like?
You know, crossing from one country, we are close geographically, but far mentally and spiritually. And to cross from Gaza to Israel, Gaza Strip, which is 40 kilometers long, and my house is not far from the border.
How many miles is that?
40, maybe 25.
25 miles long.
Long, about 9 to 10 kilometers. Six miles.
6 miles wide.
6 miles wide.
A very tiny territory. Packed with how many people?
1.5 million people there. 50% of them are children below the age of 15.
Yes.
So it's a human crisis.
So here is this walled-in area that you can't get out. You have to go through a checkpoint to get out.
It's the largest prison in the world.
Yes.
A million and a half. From the west is the Mediterranean Sea. From the north and east, Israel. And from the south is Egypt. So that's the problem. And when you cross the border, you start to be equipped mentally and spiritually. What are you going to face if you are going to cross the border or not?
You just never know if you'll make
it. You don't know. Yeah. To be equipped against the intimidation and the humiliation and to be focused at the end, to be immunized. What are you going to suffer? To be focused, I want to reach.
And you had a job. You had a full-time job.
So my eye was always to reach the hospital and to do my job, whatever the suffering is.
Yes.
And I will never give up. To be intimidated because they wanted me to give up, to feel angry, to be outraged, and to suffer because of that. I will never give up and to give them that weapon to be used against me.
So you say you stayed quiet, passive, you stayed non-aggressive.
Believe me, sometimes I'm smiling
because
I learned that I am focused. And that's what do we want to tell them, to show them, please, don't intimidate. Don't humiliate those people who are intimidated, similar to you. They have dreams, they have hopes, and intimidating them, you intimidate yourself and put yourself in their position. Imagine them.
I only visited Israel and Palestine once a couple years ago, and I stayed in the West Bank for a week and went through the border crossings where the Israeli soldiers were there with their mini guns and rounds of ammunition. And I had the magic passport, an American passport. And of course, because of America's long support for Israel and the billions and billions of dollars that have been given to support Israel and many of those to buy those very weapons the Israeli soldiers were holding, I had a pretty easy time of it. Even though I'm very tall and bearded and probably look like Osama bin Laden to them. But I still got through fairly easily. But I saw the...
What do you mean by easily?
Well, for me, they looked at my passport. They didn't search me.
The red carpet was there?
They didn't look in my luggage.
The red carpet was waiting for you?
No, it was not. But
so what was waiting for you? It wasn't even when you left. They didn't investigate you?
Well, they looked through my luggage when I left and when I entered, for sure. But it took a while. But
how
for
long?
The Palestinians, it was much, much longer because I would see them on the same bus that I'd be riding on into Jerusalem from Bethlehem or Beit Jala. And, you know, they would be taken off the bus. They would be questioned. They would be taken to a different room. I don't know what happened to them. But I know now from reading your book, I Shall Not Hate, what happens inside those rooms and how humiliating and difficult it is.
And what about an American Palestinian? Is he going to be treated as you were treated?
I doubt it.
So why? But he's American also.
Yes.
He's an American.
Yeah.
And that's what do we want to get beyond that. Uh-huh. Those security procedures, instead of asking why are we doing it, there is some cause behind it. Why am I afraid from you?
Yes.
I am afraid from you because maybe I did something wrong to you. And I feel threatened by you. You are waiting to get revenge. So I have to be honest with you and, first of all, to take responsibility about this fear and to protect myself of not hiding and hiding my head and my body in sand like the ostrich and to justify what am I doing. I have to have the moral courage to say, I am ready. Please come. What do you want? How can we get rid of that?
Here you are, a doctor, a medical doctor with a full-time job at an important hospital, Ben-Gurion Hospital at one point. And is that in Tel Aviv?
No, it's Soroka University Hospital in Beersheba and then Tel HaShomer Hospital in Tel Aviv.
Ah, okay. And here you had received your college and medical studies in Cairo and Egypt. You had also studied in Saudi Arabia and in London, England. You had a master's of public health degree from Harvard University in the United States. You'd come to this country at great sacrifice well into your career to get that additional degree to be able to better help the public health in Gaza and for Palestinians in Israel and the West Bank. You had all of that, and yet it would take you forever to get out of Gaza to go to a conference or to investigate working for the United Nations or to eventually come to Toronto. And you describe that so thoroughly, so well in your book, I Shall Not Hate. People who read that can really get a sense of what it's like to be a Gazan. And you were an important person, not only to the Gazans, but to the Israelis, because you were delivering their babies. You were helping with their infertility problems. That was one of your specialties.
But I learned from that nothing is impossible, and I'm telling the people, the audience, be focused, be determined, persistent. And how much do you face challenges, those challenges not to stop you from reaching there? It took time, and I learned I will never give up. It may be difficult, but at the end, I reach there. So with all of those sufferings, when I'm crossing the borders, my eye always on the goal, to reach the other place, to reach the people that I am willing to serve and to help. When I came from Jordan, from Belgium, to Germany, to reach my wife, when she was sick, she was dying, was the journey to death.
She had leukemia.
She has leukemia.
Yes.
It took me more than 24 hours. And no one can listen or feel the suffering that I am going to see.
And that journey should have taken how long?
1 hour.
An hour.
To take 24 hours.
Yeah.
And I said, I called it, it's the journey to death.
Yeah.
To see a dead person. And that's the suffering of Palestinians, and each of us must feel that.
Yes.
And to stand for this cause, to prevent it. Still, it is continuing.
I want people to read your book, and I don't want people to think that it's all horrible. Much of it describes what you've just said, which is horrible. But somehow, you managed to get even humor in this book. Some of the stories you tell when you were a child, like thinking you were helping a cousin by taking socks your first time out of Gaza to go to Cairo, and finding out that he was using you as a courier to get those socks there that without paying duty on them. People get very desperate sometimes when they're very poor. But you tell some very funny stories. I thought the story about the border crossing, where the border guards ended up blowing up your briefcase that had your passport in it and all of that, had a very interesting last sentence or two, because it was Gazans, it was Palestinians, border guards. This time you're going from Israel back into Palestine, and you accidentally left your briefcase on a stone while you know that they were interviewing you. You got back on the bus and went on, left the briefcase. They thought it was suspicious, blew up their fellow Gazans' doctor's briefcase. I mean, you have irony, you have humor in this story. I just commend it to listeners. So we have another caller waiting. I want to go back to the phones. Line number one. Yes, you're on the air with our guest today.
Good evening. I have not read the book, but I think your story is a wonderful story about humanity and what we can do as humans. I'd like your comment on something that I have been studying. And I had a spiritual teacher who talked about compassion as being a higher level than forgiveness. And what he said was, you can only have compassion when you experience what, either in your mind or your soul or in actual events, what the other person who you have anger toward, whatever level of anger it is, and that when you understand the enormous pressures that caused that person to treat you so ill, that forgiveness is not even an issue.
That's a wonderful point. And what do you think, Dr. Abalesh, about what our caller raises about the importance of compassion being perhaps at a higher spiritual level than even forgiveness?
I fully agree. You know, compassion and passion, we need them. And they are at a higher level because forgiveness, it needs some requirements, but compassion, you feel it, you practice it, and that's the purpose of life when God created us from Adam and Eve and became nations and tribes. For what? To know each other, and knowing is the respect, compassion, and passion, and to feel it and to practice it in life, each of us.
Let me give an example from your book of compassion. A Jewish woman, a leader, an Israeli woman, who was a leader of the peace camp here in the United States in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where your three daughters who were so tragically murdered in war had gone. Your three daughters, had those three had all gone to this camp, or just two of the three?
Bisan, the eldest, she went.
She went twice.
Dalal, she went once. Shada, who was severely wounded,
She was the third.
Yeah,
okay.
She was the third. But Mayar and I was planning to send them.
As well.
Later, yeah.
And this is a camp where...
For only girls.
Only for girls. And I might say that your foundation focuses on women and girls.
For only girls.
Only, yes, only women
and that's
and
why
girls,
when they
because
called me...
Because you see, that's where the hope for the future lies.
I fully believe in it,
yes.
That the girls are the hope. And I can say to you, this world, when it was created, one woman turned it... upside down. And I think girls and women in this world, they can correct this world.
Daughtersforlife.com is where the foundation information can be found. You asked me to read a poem that this Israeli woman from this camp where Israeli girls and Palestinian girls go for several weeks and learn to really love one another. But after your daughter Bisan died, this Israeli woman came to the hospital was with your surviving daughter.
With my daughter, Nee, she spent 6 weeks.
6 weeks with
close
her.
To her.
Yes.
Working hard day and night to be close to her, to take care of her as her daughter.
We only have a minute or two, so I won't be able to finish this poem, but let me read the beginnings of this poem by an Israeli woman about her memory of Bisan. I long to touch you, Bisan, one more time to hug you, to tell you how sorry I am that your mom died. But now you too are gone, your smiling face, your gentle way, your softness, your non-judgmental words, your pain for your people, your way of life, your dreams, aspirations, and your hope for peace. Just days before the war, I spoke with your dad. He gave me your phone number. It is still in my car. Every day I glance at the numbers, seeing your name, Bisan. I wish I had spoken with you more, but I didn't have the guts. I spoke with you 3 days before you died. I told you that I am praying for your safety. My prayers were not heard through the shelling, the bombing, the Qassams, the rockets being fired from Gaza into Israel, the smoke. I feel I have been betrayed by God, by my country, by the cruelty of humanity, by the warmongers, by those who think violence is the solution. And with all of this, I have been given a gift to have spent 6 weeks with Sharatha, Izzeldin, Atta, and Gaida. I heard no words of revenge nor hatred. I heard no anger. I heard the deep belief that peace is possible. Even with this enormous loss, I have been strengthened from their strength. I am more determined from their determination. I am more at peace with their peacefulness. Bisan, forgive me. Bisan, forgive me for not being able to save you from my own people. Forgive me for giving you hope that peace is possible, and then taking that dream from you. You will always be my symbol of hope, peace, and mostly gentleness. Your dad shared a dream with me days after you died. He came into a room full of men, and there you were sitting amongst them. He asked you, why are you sitting here? You know it's not acceptable in our society. You answered, all is fine now, Dad. I'm happy and well. I can be here now among the men where I am needed. May no other woman need to die in order to be able to influence the men as you have, Bisan. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.